All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Equation of Excellence. I have a special episode for you all. We are out here at Shop Talk, and we have our fearless leader, CEO, my boss, co-founder, Rishib Jain. Thank you for joining the show.
Yeah, of course. And most importantly, better at holding down my alcohol than Rubba.
Oh, my gosh. My boss can party harder than me. He can meme better than me. I didn't have that on my 2024 bingo card, but we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you.
Let's do it.
What was the first thing that got you involved in entrepreneurship? What was your first business, or what was the first thing you did?
Okay. So I don't know why, but ever since high school, I had this belief that business was the best way to propagate ideas in the world. So it's like, I don't have the typical story of like, oh, I was in high school and I was like selling CDs or anything like that. In fact, I was the opposite. I was like studying all the time and like getting good grades.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, I knew that only way to distribute ideas widely in the world was to do it in a way in which was self-sustaining, which meant profitable business. And so then ever since high school, like if you were to read my college application essay, it like reads like a prediction of my life.
Really?
Which is like, which is like,
we should post
that. I'm going to.
It's embarrassing.
Actually, I might. No, I mean, if I can find it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Find it. Yeah. I was like, hey, I want to study business engineering because I want to build things and then I want to push them out into the world.
You have a pretty impeccable CV. Was Wharton the first choice you got in, or did you have a lot? I mean, because. It's a proper school.
Yeah, it was my second choice. Yeah.
Really? Who rejected you?
Stanford.
No. So does Evelyn look down her nose?
I haven't told her.
No way. Oh, I hope she listens to the podcast. No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So Stanford was my number one choice. And I got waitlisted and then did not get in. And Penn was number two at this like business engineering program. And then the same thing happened for my PhD.
Yeah.
Where... Actually, for my PhD, I did get into Stanford, but I was like, man, I really want to go to Stanford. Yeah. And then for other reasons, I was like, you know what? MIT is just better. So I'm just going to go to MIT.
It's the ivory tower. It's the school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Okay. So graduate, you do, because what is that? 7 years, 8 years of academia? Because you have four for the undergrad and then another four for your PhD?
10. I did four for undergrad. Then I won one of those fellowships that takes you to London for a year. So I lived in London.
Oh, that's why you're... Okay. Yeah.
So then I did physics there, and then I did 5 years at MIT. So 10 years total.
Okay. So when did you get into entrepreneurship?
Okay. So I started building my first businesses when I was a PhD student.
Okay.
So the first one was like a solar energy company.
Okay.
And that was... clearly a bad idea. At the time, solar was really hot. So 2011, Solyndra, all these things, they were super hot. And then they all busted in 2012. And so I had built a solar energy company. Actually, we funded the company entirely on prize money because it was such a hot idea.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was such a hot idea that I just like racked up prize money.
A ton of government subsidies too.
Yeah. So that was the first business that failed. The second business was like, basically like a lab data sharing platform.
Okay.
And then that one ended up not working out because we had a co-founder disagreement. And then I was like, okay, I got to go become a better manager. And then that's when I went into the ad tech world after my PhD.
Okay, the LiveRamp.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing. Speaking of co-founders, Shreyas, wonderful human as well. How did you know he was going to be the guy for Fermat? Like, did you guys do previous excursions together? Or
yeah.
Because I think a co-founder is a really tricky one to choose, right?
Yeah, it's super tricky. And I am learning now as I like hang out with more founders at like series B, C, D stages that it's actually rare for co-founders to have a durable relationship.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually more common for something to happen. Yeah.
I can't think of the investor, but there was a really big, awesome investor that I really look up to. And one of the heuristics they use for success is how long have the co-founders been together?
Yeah.
Because kind of like a Lindy effect, right? Like they've been together for 10 years. They'll probably be together for another 10, but 6 months to a year, you don't know what's going to happen.
Totally.
So did you have like any heuristics or any proxies or any like red flags where it's like this? Or like, give me some more like meat on the bone there.
Yeah. So ultimately there was two things that I thought about when thinking about who's the right co-founder. The first is they're a co-founder first and they're technical second.
Got it. Yep.
Meaning, if I'm not running the boat and if that person is running the boat, the business will be fine.
Yep.
So that was the first thing. It's like, yes, I want somebody who is technical, who has complementary skills, but they cannot be an engineer first and a co-founder second. So that's like the most important thing is co-founder first, engineer second. And the second thing I thought about was like, is this person actually aligned with what kind of company we want to build? Like, I knew that I wanted to build a massive company and otherwise it was not worth my time.
Yep.
And so the other person needed to be okay with that. Meaning like if a $200 million exit opportunity showed up, they needed to be comfortable with me saying no.
Yes.
Right. We're going to go all the way or it's going to go bust type of thing. Yeah.
So interesting. That's so interesting. So LiveRamp and then Fermat, like what made you start the company? Like what? Because it pivoted. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So give the people a little bit of color of kind of the trajectory, because it's been really cool to see, especially now, man, the product is getting really crazy.
We've laid a bit of an inflection point. So what the original inspiration for the company was, when you can no longer track people from app to website or website to website, what if you could just build closed loop systems, meaning like wherever you enter, the rest of the purchase journey was closed loop to that.
Yep.
And so it's like, okay, the way that we do that is we build a backend that can create like many stores and you do the one-to-one. At the time, influencers were super hot.
Yeah.
And so I thought that that front end was an influencer storefront.
Got it.
And so we built this influencer product and all of this other stuff. And it turns out influencer was like a flash in the pan. I mean, not in like a negative way, but it's like, it doesn't drive as much revenue as the other core channels. So it's like, ultimately, like paid media, email, SMS, those are the core revenue drivers of e-commerce.
Yeah.
And influencer is just a small component of it, which is not to say it's not important, but it's a smaller component. I didn't appreciate that. And I thought like, oh my God, like influencer's gonna come and start taking share from the other ones.
Yeah.
And so that's what, that realization was what then pivoted us to like, actually, we need to build a platform for brands that is channel agnostic.
Yes.
We cannot bet heavy on just influencer. We have to be like paid, retention, influencer, every channel. And the bet on that one channel and assuming it was going to take over, that was the mistake.
No, I love that. I would push back a little bit and saying it was almost you were building a feature, not a business. And you realized that and you're like, okay, cool. Totally. This is like, because the influencer product still is awesome. Like, I mean, the current state of the product, you can use it for influencers.
But it's
a feature, not a business. And so I think that for me anyways, was the realization from the outside looking in where it's like, okay, yes, let's give you these big foundational levers and then influencers can slot into that.
Exactly. So the mistake I made, to phrase it a little better, is I thought influencer was the platform.
Got it.
And I realized that actually the platform is the stores and influencers a channel.
Yeah.
And so that's what reframed the entire business. Yeah. Because we were building totally differently when you think that the influencers are the platform.
You know, I love that. Yeah. How do you shepherd a company through a pivot like that?
Oh my God. So,
because it's hard, right?
So I did not think it was going to be hard.
Yeah.
But ended up being harder than I thought.
Yeah.
Because I was so super comfortable. Like, I have no emotional attachment to things that have happened in the past, especially on the product side. Yeah. On the people side, it's a little harder. But on the product side, it's like, yeah, it's not working. Yeah. Kill it. And then I got a ton of backlash from the engineers saying like, hey, Rishabh, we spent all this time building this. Like, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again?
Yeah.
And I remember I was in at one of our town halls at the time. And I said, guys, I had a bunch of commentary from people asking like, how does this not happen again? And like, people were nodding along. Yeah. And I was like, let me reframe this for you. The company you do not want to work at is the one that's unwilling to kill things that are not working. Oh,
100%.
And in fact, the question should be, Rishabh, how do we make sure this happens again? Because 100%. That's the sign of a good company.
Yes.
It's like, you're willing to kill things if it's not working. And the fact that we killed it, that's the good signal. It is not the bad signal.
That's so well put. And I think there's almost another layer to that where killing good ideas is the hard part. Like, saying no to like
totally
bad shit. It's like, yeah, it's dummy, like kill it. But like the things that aren't great, that aren't the 100X, like when you hired me this, you were always pushing like, Rob, I love that you're doing it, but focus on the 10X things, focus on the 100X. We can get to the optimization stage later in the growth curve. But right now it's hockey stick, 10X, 10X. And so I think that's a big challenge in product is saying no to the really good ideas because they then push out the great ones.
This is why I love Alexa, by the way.
Yeah.
She's great. Very good at saying no to things that are good ideas, but not actually like thing that's going to move the needle.
The needle movers.
And by the way, that's like starting to happen more and more to us now.
Yeah.
I'm just getting, we're very fortunate right now. We're getting inbound with a lot of good ideas.
Yes.
And so we're having to now say no to good ideas.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely the path. What's like the biggest mistake you've made as a CEO and what is the best decision you've made as a CEO?
Okay, I'll start with the best decision. I have to think a little bit harder about like the biggest, I mean, I made tons of mistakes, but I want to think about what is a good big mistake too. Yeah. So I would say the best decisions I made are all like betting big on high quality people.
Yeah.
And then just letting them do their thing.
Yeah.
And I think that it's like early on in the business, like the first one was Trace, obviously bringing him out as a co-founder, by far the best decision.
Yeah.
And then
was there any convincing there or was he all in from the get?
It was like actually a very complicated story. So I was co-founder dating with somebody else who I worked with at LiveRamp.
Yep.
Who happens to also be a friend of Shreyas's.
Oh.
And that person said no. And then Shreyas was just like, you said no? Yeah. Are you crazy? And so then Shreyas emailed me saying, like, hey, I heard Charles is no longer gonna do it. Would you be open to me being the co-founder?
Interesting.
And I was like, absolutely. I thought you didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we worked together for a month and then that's how he ended up becoming co-founder. Yeah.
No, I love that.
But that was by far the best decision.
Okay. And then
worst decision. I would say that the worst decision probably was, you know, it probably had to do with capital efficiency early on.
Yeah.
You know, starting a company in 2021, capital was free.
Yeah. It was zerpy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you also felt like it was free. And so some of our decisions early on in terms of like capital efficiency, I don't think that they were smart decisions. Like I was hiring people that were like good but not great. Yep. I was doing spends that were good but not great. Yep. And it's like, you really should not be doing that in the early parts of the business.
Yeah. No, yeah, you have to be. I mean, there's nothing wrong with missing every now and then, but you're right in that sense. Like for me personally, because I think actually the role of the CEO is twofold. It's don't run out of money and vision.
Totally.
And I think the role of a CMO is capital deployment, efficient, effective capital deployment and getting momentum or keeping momentum. Those are basically the two value vectors.
So well said. So well said.
No notes from
so well said. This is why you live in my head. You live in my head.
What keeps you up at night as a CEO?
People. Only thing. So at some point, somebody told me that the seed money is for finding product market fit.
Yeah.
And then the Series A is for hiring the 1.0 executive team.
And interesting. I've never heard that before. I
haven't heard that before either. I heard it like a month ago.
Okay? Yeah, that's very good.
And this has like reframed everything for me.
Yeah.
Because what I have started to realize is that it is way more true than I could have expected.
Yeah.
Because like the business is working right now. Right? Like the basic mechanics of the business is working. The product is really hitting.
Yeah.
And so the thing to pay a lot of attention to is like, are the right people in the right seats at all points in time of the business? And it's like, that part is so hard and it's way harder than I would have expected.
Yeah. No, I've never started my own, or I mean, I had my own little boutique shop, but it's nothing like entrepreneurship because it's cash flow. It's not this big bet that you have to then board, blah, blah, blah. But I just have to deal with the nonsense in the marketing department. You're the dad over every single department. So it's just every little thing bubbles up to you. And that's a big matzo ball hanging out there every time. When do you start indexing heavily on systems and processes? Because I feel like there's a lot of people that, not to cut you off, but a lot of people that can get the cart before the horse, where I think there's a certain phase of a company early on where I'd rather have results than the perfect system.
Totally.
And I think a lot of people index on like OKRs, blah, blah, blah. And like in the later stages at Triple Whale, there was just this fetishization of process and people weren't performing, but they could tell you how much they sucked. And that was just like my nightmare fuel. It's like, I understand the need for it and processes and systems and things like that. Like, again, I'm a big Notion maxi, that nature, but how do you think of that in terms of the order of operations and like in terms of timeline and implementation?
Okay. So I have two ways of thinking about this. The first one is, I think systems are relevant when that can actually help you do your job better.
Like a multiplier or something.
Yeah, it should be a multiplier. So like, it's always people first and systems second, not like systems that. First and people second. Like, and so it's like, you want to trust the people and the organization. And then if they need the systems, then they will figure out the systems, right? It's like, but you cannot do systems first and then people and say like, hey, here's the system, plug into it.
Exactly.
Like, that never works. Yeah. And that doesn't work at this scale. It doesn't work at 1,000 people either. Yeah. Because when I was at LiveRamp, it was like, you know, 1,200 people.
Yeah.
Trust me, like trying to push systems down does not work.
It doesn't work.
So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is like, systems should be thought about as like, what are the sets of activities that I want to put on autopilot?
Mm-hmm.
And everything else should not be a system.
Yeah.
So it's like, it should allow you to worry about the big problems.
Yeah.
And if it's doing the inverse, which is like, it's getting in the way of you solving problems, yeah. then it's, again, you should just not. So that's how I think about systems.
No, that's really well said. I have almost like a Hippocratic oath type of thing for systems where it should at worst never make you less efficient. Like if the system is making you worse, then nuke the system and just do it by hand. But it's hard sometimes, especially for engineers or even myself, where if you do this thing one off, but then you want to make this like fancy little system for it. And there's just all the programmer jokes of like, they're going to spend 4 hours to write a script when they could have just done it in like manually, but totally, inefficiently totally. In 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's an interesting balance.
Yeah. I think some people like the comfort of systems also. And so that's also something to be careful of.
Because that's why I don't like systems people, because you can hide.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you have to be careful in the early days of a company, because you're, what is that thing? It's like, you're putting in work, but you're not actually going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly yeah, right. So. Especially too, there's a, just because it's meaningful to you, it took you a long time and it was really hard, doesn't make it valuable. Like totally. I can go dig a hole in the backyard and sweating and blah, blah, blah. And like, but what, there's no business impact to it. And I think that's where I get really sketched out sometimes when people are over indexed on systems. You're quite the stock picker. Give me some macro predictions for 2024. What do you think? We got a presidential election coming up. We got TikTok ban on the horizon.
I'm not a macro guy. I'm a micro guy.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not macro. No. Yeah. I
so
don't
that's
do
why
any,
you can pick the stocks.
That's
so
why
well,
I do stock picking. Yeah, micro. Exactly. I'm a micro guy, not a macro guy.
Okay. Okay. Well, that blew me up then.
But let me tell you my micro.
Okay.
Okay. So first of all, I think when you think about investing, yes, it's a good idea to invest in the market, and the market has grown in the US, and the US is a great economy, so you should just do that. When it comes to stock picking, it is a micro problem. Yes. And so it's like, Zuck is amazing. And I think to not recognize that is like unbelievable to me. And so it's like, bet on the micro. It's like the micro is Zuck is amazing.
Yeah.
He's going to figure it out. He has like such a track record of both building and buying, which is very hard to do. And so it's like, okay, I have a lot of money in Facebook, and that has done very well.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think like that's how I think about micro is like, what are the specific things that are true about individual companies that are standout? So like Shopify, the thing that people don't appreciate about Shopify is that the app ecosystem is a like self-fulfilling prophecy that it will always make the ecosystem builder bigger. I was like talking
and better
and better. Yeah, exactly. I was talking to a merchant on BigCommerce the other day, and he was like, so upset that he was on BigCommerce.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I have nothing against it, but this person was just like frustrated because he felt like he was constrained. And so it's like those types of feelings are what's going to drive business for Shopify.
Yeah. Right? No, so. I'm with you there. And I think they have that perfect duo in Harley and Toby, where you just have this very technical person that understands really where the market goes. And then you just have this uber charismatic guy that just says everything right.
Totally.
Doesn't want to hang out with Hartley. And I think that's just, that is really, really amazing, especially as you, like the way they handle all the pushback of kind of Sherlocking apps and stuff. I thought it was just beautiful, where Toby's like, hey, we're just going to build these foundational ones. And if you still want the bells and whistles, get Recharge, get whatever, like, but we're going to give you this baseline subscription to help these people kind of long tail. And then if you want to get fancy, then you just switch to something and pay other people.
You know what's interesting? Toby is by far the biggest advocate in the company of ensuring that the partner ecosystem is always happy.
100%.
By far.
100%.
Yeah. And it's like other people who are advocating for internal tools. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Let's stay on the forecasting a little bit.
Yeah.
What are your predictions for 2024 for the D2C e-commerce space? Any spicy ones? Any hot takes?
I think two big ones. The first one is, I think that up until last year, there was such a focus on like, we've got to go retail. We've got to go retail. Yeah. We've got to reduce spend on paid acquisition. Yeah. And I think this year it's going to flip.
Really?
Yeah. I think people are going to be like, oh my God, now I remember why I was doing D2C. Retail is such a pain.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's my first hot take.
That's pretty hot one. I like it. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think my second hot take is that I think that by the end of the year, there will be venture dollars going into consumer again.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that D2C brands will be like, I mean, I don't think they're going to raise massive money like, the Caspers of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there will be like good investments that are happening in D2C e-commerce again.
Interesting. I like those takes. Those are pretty strong.
Yeah.
I don't hate them. It'll be interesting to see, because there's the joke, D2C is a channel, not a business.
Totally.
So it'll be interesting. I think that is actually, though, only relevant to certain run rates. Where I think when you start to get proper big, where it's like 100, 200 million, like you have to get into retail, wholesale, things of that nature. Before we wrap up, I would be remiss not to ask you, what's your favorite watch? What's the best watch ever made?
Ooh. Okay.
For people that don't know, exquisite tastes in watch and timepieces.
Yeah. Okay. I like Patek has a blue face perpetual calendar, which I think is one of the most beautiful watches that I've ever seen. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
It's a six figure watch.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But it's an investment.
It's holding it. Someday. Someday.
It's holding it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one that I really like.
Yeah.
And then I like, on the other side, that's classy. This one, the Patek is classy. And then on the like fun side, mm-hmm. I like MBNF is. Okay. MBF, yeah.
So no AP. No AP guy.
Yeah. AP is too popular. AP is too popular. I can't get behind things that are too popular. So I would never buy a Rolex.
Yeah. I'm actually in the exact same boat. I have the same preference set. Okay. Last question. What is your equation for excellence? What do you think excellence is a function of?
I think excellence is a function of the size of the bet that you are taking and the number of swings that you take.
I love that.
And so the bigger the size of the bet and the bigger the number of swings, and that is those are the only two things that matter.
Be at the table and then know when to go heavy and when to go all in.
That's why you and I only talk about having turned the table.
Rishabh, thank you so much for joining me. I know you have a meeting to go to. Go check us out, firmatcommerce.com. Go book a demo. Rishabh's actually very active on LinkedIn. Check him out there. And incredible Twitters. Your meme niche is it's something to marvel at. It's incredible. Also, if you go to firmatcommerce.com, we have a great newsletter, Geometry of Growth, goes out every Monday. Go check it out there. And then we have a sister show called D2C Hunter, where I get to light up the ramp and do a whole bunch of analysis on the consumer journey from pre-purchase to unboxing. All right. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.